This is the 13th annual Kennedy Assassination Special here on Coast to Coast AM. I'm your host this evening, Dave Schrader. Thank you for joining me. One of the aspects I was intrigued by with this case was, as you've heard on Coast to Coast many times, the idea of remote viewing. And has anyone ever seriously invested time in remote viewing the Kennedy assassination? If so, what did they glean from that story? Joe McMonagall is one of the people that I reached out to. He was unable to join us, but he did send an email, and I'd like to read this. I thought it was kind of an intriguing aspect. He said, I'll be traveling and will not be available for the time of the interview. Again, I'm sorry. I probably wouldn't be any fun anyway because I don't like talking about the remote viewing I did on the Kennedy assassination. I've pinned it down to a very specific reason that isn't very nice and too close to home for comfort's sake. Of course, if you're interested in talking about my views, feel free to share this with your audience. You know, of course, that when the Cuban Missile Crisis began, his popularity in America was way down in the high 20s somewhere. Also, you know that he was getting as many as 6 or 7 shots a day in his lower back from a White House doctor. Only this doctor was a chemist who was injecting Kennedy with a mixture of speed, anabolic steroids, painkillers, etc. Steroids, of course, one should never take more than 1 or 2 of these in a 6-month period because they can cause all kinds of emotional instability. Well, this chemist hooked not only Kennedy, the president, but just about everyone else close to him in the White House. On top of this, Khrushchev's KGB broke into the chemist's office and obtained a list of all of those people who were hooked on the speed and steroids. So now we walk into the Cuban Missile Crisis with a drugged president in the mid to upper 20s of popularity who, at the very beginning, gets his butt chewed by Khrushchev for his errant behavior. It's my belief that because of all of this, as witnessed by most of the cabinet who were with him during the Mexican standoff with Khrushchev, with Kennedy going into roid rage probably more than once during this time frame, and then having Khrushchev back down. Well, immediately afterward, Kennedy's popularity with the people jumped into the mid to high 90s. So now the cabinet has a president they're working for who's hooked on drugs, who probably won't back down when he gets into it with Khrushchev again, knowing he can't be impeached, replaced, or voted out of office, and the next time it will probably go to a nuclear exchange. If you were in the cabinet of a significant agency responsible to the American people for their safety, and you observed this all occurring over a 5 to 6 day period, the question is, what would you do? And yes, he was triangulated between the upper level of the book storage building, somewhere above Oswald, the fence line on the knoll, and a gutter opening from the bridge edge toward the front. And yes, Oswald was a patsy, a mark, set to take up the hit. And yes, Jack Ruby was a backup to kill Oswald so he couldn't prove he didn't do it, etc. Now, a great book, he says, that came out not too long ago that changes or goes into this very deeply is called Dr. Feelgood, The Shocking Story of the Doctor Who May Have Changed History by Treating and Drugging JFK, Marilyn, Elvis, and Other Statements, and wrote about having done the remote viewing in my book, Ultimate Time Machine. And, of course, they say in the book that they weren't a doctor at all. He was a chemist, and that came from Joe McMonagall. Interesting aspect of it, we did reach out to another group who has been touting that they did a very fascinating in-depth remote viewing session, and they were originally scheduled to join us this evening, and they had to back out at the last minute saying that they were being pursued under legal actions for something that they had been working on. So we were unable to get involved with them. So joining us for the remainder of the show tonight, Chris Milligan and, of course, Jim Bothello, a former Marine roommate of Lee Harvey Oswald, will join us fresh off of the, I believe, 3rd annual JFK assassination conference that took place this weekend. We'll talk with them about their unique perspective and aspects on this case, and we'll do that next on Coast to Coast AM. The 3rd annual JFK assassination conference just took place November 20th, 21st, and 22nd. Joining us from the conference, Chris Milligan, And he is a writer, researcher, and publisher whose father was in the Office of Strategic Services, military intelligence, and later in the CIA, rising to branch chief, head of intelligence analysis for East Asia. His father told Chris some things that he didn't understand in the late 60s, and these revelations led to over 30 years of research into the subjects of CIA drugs, clandestine operations, conspiracy theory, and secret societies. Also joining us this hour is Jim Batello, and he's a former Marine roommate of Lee Harvey Oswald. Shared a room with him for approximately 2 months prior to his discharge. He later became a California judge. And Mr. Batello served in the United States Marine Corps from January 8th, 1957 to January 8th, 1960, and served with Lee Harvey Oswald from about March to September of 1959. While both were attached to a Marine Air Control Squadron, number 9, Marine Corps Air Facility in Santa Ana, California. Gentlemen, welcome to the show.
Thank you very, very much.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Talk to me a little bit about the conference. This is your third annual conference. Chris, I know that you're one of the producers and behind this program. How many people did you have turn out for this one?
Well, we got about 170 people. It was really quite a good group of people. And the speakers that we had were just amazing. It was historic. We got some people together who hadn't, on some panels, who hadn't met each other. And the discussion was just amazing. We started off with Robert Groden, who was the person who did the first public showing of the Zapruder film and was on, was an investigator for the House committee. And then we had a gentleman who was a journalist on the ground at the RFK killing, because November 20th was Robert Kennedy's birthday. And he did a lot of research about a girl who officially still doesn't exist, but the girl with the polka dot dress who ran out of the building said, "We shot the president." He's done some amazing research. He was a reporter on the ground. And then we had Peter Dale Scott, one of the deans of research into the deep state. And the next day we started off with Jim Botello, who is an amazing person who just, you know, I mean, he knew Lee, and we had two people at this conference that knew Lee Oswald, Jim Botello, and then Judith Ferry Baker, the author of Me and Lee, and also a book about David Ferry, because she knew Lee Harvey Oswald. And then we had an autopsy panel with people who were some of the technicians during the autopsy. We had a gentleman who was in the honor guard, who carried the casket, and it's just amazing all of the perfidy and the lies that is in the autopsy. And that's one thing that, you know, I don't like to use the word proof very often, because proof really belongs in court. But the testimony from the people at Bethesda proves that Lee Oswald didn't kill Kennedy, because Lee Oswald was dead when a lot of the things that were happening at the morgue. And the evidence is just overwhelming.
I'm sorry, clear that up for me. Lee Harvey Oswald was dead when?
Well, he died on the 24th. Okay,
right.
So actually, before the... but. It would have been, he was in jail, and it would have been hard for him to affect the autopsy that was done by, you know, military personnel at Bethesda Morgue. And the evidence is just overwhelming. One thing we had testimony there was from the honor guard and the people at Bethesda. And one thing that happened was, earlier this year, a gentleman from Chicago got the honor guard together for the first time with the people at the Bethesda Morgue. And you can't believe how betrayed the honor guard felt when they heard the testimony from the Bethesda technicians that told about how they received the president's body a half hour before the honor guard showed up carrying the casket. So when they first heard it, the people from the honor guard, they couldn't believe it. They almost came to blows because they thought, okay, these people are lying. But after a while, they figured out, well, okay, you aren't lying, and I'm not lying. Well, something hinky happened. And then when you get into the X-ray evidence and stuff, it is just overwhelming of the evidence that shows that there was way more than Lee Oswald involved.
I know we had Judith Very Baker on our show, Darkness Radio, last year. We also had her on Coast to Coast AM. Fascinating story and a totally different perspective. To sit in studio, she was in Minneapolis and had visited our studio, to sit in front of this woman who knew, loved, and was close to Lee Harvey Oswald, to see the way that she would react as she would tell different aspects of the story, it was fascinating. You know, like many people, I believe that Oswald may have been a patsy, but was involved at some level in this assassination attempt, until I sat before this woman who gave me a different perspective, opened my eyes to a couple of different angles to this case. And that really started to open my paradigms and shift them from what we've been told for so long, which by this time in history, 53 plus years in, it has seemed to change every year. You know, we've heard everything from the driver did it to, you know, LBJ pulled the trigger himself, to I'm sure somewhere in the grassy knoll, you know, George Bush Sr. was eating a peanut butter sandwich and took the shot. Everybody's got a different angle on the story. Everybody has a different viewpoint of how this is going. Do you believe that we are still uncovering information that will eventually one day lead to the real answer behind what happened, or will this always be suppressed?
Absolutely. I mean, we do have, 2017 isn't that far away. That's when all the information is supposed to be released. And, we're going to find out, because there's still a lot of documentation. But one thing that was just driven home at this conference over and over again is that there is a lot of documentation that shows, and yes, the thing was done with intelligence protocols, which leads us into a wilderness of mirrors, okay, where there's a lot of misdirection. So there's a lot of things that, they're still kind of mushy and we maybe don't all agree on, but the things that have really come out and have really become solidified that we can agree on is that Lee Oswald was working within the intelligence community of the United States, okay? He was creating legends and stuff. And then, yes, he did infiltrate the plot, okay, and then was the patsy of the plot. And, a patsy, what does a patsy do? A patsy puts a frame around himself and dies, okay? And then the other thing that really all of us can agree on is that it was a coup d'etat, because if Lee Oswald didn't shoot him, then somebody else did, and it was a coup d'etat, and we lost our country, and the people that did that are still in power today.
You do talk, as you said, you had all of these great speakers, all of these different people with perspectives that have come together, and in all of those speakers, they do agree that Lee Harvey Oswald was not involved in this. Is that correct?
Yes,
absolutely. Oswald's personality wouldn't have let him commit such a serious crime to our president. He was working for the CIA and the FBI at a very low level, and he knew that that was such a low level, he wouldn't compromise his principles to commit such a high crime for the country, against the country, and that he was working for in a very secret capacity.
Right. For a man who is such a detractor, allegedly, of the U.S. government and of the president, when he was arrested, he was still wearing his Marine ring. Is that right? He was still,
Sorry.
Yes, he was. And, you talked a little bit early about Judith Ferry Baker. And, it was very interesting. First, we did a book, it was called Mary Ferry and the Monkey Virus, and we turned it into Dr. Mary's Monkey. An amazing book that goes into quite a bit of things, into a secret project to kill Fidel Castro.
Right, Ed Haslam's book, correct?
Right. And then Ed brought us Judy's book. And, I looked at it, and, first time I heard about Judy, I says, well, no way, she'd be dead. And, we spent 2 years going through her amazing documentation, because she was this 19-year-old girl that got pulled into this secret project. She'd been given years of high-level medical training since she was in high school. And it was just... she was in a secret project, so she started saving all these pieces of paper of her bus tickets and all kinds of things, and she had her W-2s, she had her paychecks from Riley Coffee and Standard Coffee, and we had to verify all those and look into it and talk to witnesses, and there were witnesses of people that saw her and Lee in New Orleans. And then the other thing about her story was, anybody who researches the JFK assassination, well, you can maybe understand some things, but then there's a lot of things out there that they didn't make sense. I mean, what was going on? And then when you read Judy's book, me and Lee, a bunch of these just anomalies, all of a sudden, it makes sense of what was going on. And so it was just a pleasure to publish her book. Of course, she got attacked mercilessly. People calling her everything from being a fantasist to making it all up to just whatever. But it has shown and gone through time. I mean, the book's been out now for 4 years. We've taken her to press conferences. She's been on radio shows. She doesn't shy from questions. She lets people talk to her. And she is who she says she is. And it is an amazing story. And then we had Jim, who was, new Lee in the Marine Corps. And, I never knew Lee. All I know is what the media told me. Here was this vile guy who, killed our president because he wants to be famous. Well, when you talk to people who actually knew him, that wasn't the case.
Lee was very much of an introvert, and he enjoyed being an introvert. He wanted to be an introvert. He is independent and very secretive in his actions and philosophy. He was a private person. And humble, though certain times he could be very contentious and arrogant if people accused him of certain things, and he would pretty much get within himself and utilize his arrogance.
Now, do you believe, I know a lot of people that are introverts will appear arrogant or overconfident when, in fact, what it is their silence and their way of processing and handling things is to be so standoffish it gives this fake air. Do you believe that there was truly a fake air, or was he so intelligent and self-confident of who he was that he just thought people were below him and he was much more intelligent?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. He didn't consider anyone him better than anyone else.
Jim Botello and Chris Milligan are guests for the remainder of tonight's show. We'll open up phone lines next hour if you have questions for them regarding the JFK assassination. Stay tuned. We've got more coming your way right here on Coast to Coast AM. Don't forget, tomorrow night for Coast Insiders, there's a live chat at 8 p.m. Pacific time, 11 p.m. Eastern, with Linda Moulton Howe. If you'd like to become a member, it's real simple. Just go to coasttocoastam.com, become an insider. A one-year subscription breaks down only 15 cents a day to give you over 5 years of past archive shows of the best in overnight talk radio, live access to the hosts and to the guests that you hear on the show, exclusive content, and more. Go check out coasttocoastam.com and become a Coast Insider today, and you'll find out why we are the best in overnight talk radio. While you're there, make sure you stop by and check out and see what's going on with George's TV show, Beyond Belief. You can find previews and information right there on the site. Never miss another episode. Never miss another update with what George Norrie is doing next. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue with our guests this evening, Chris Milligan and Jim Botello. Jim, a former Marine roommate of Lee Harvey Oswald, what was his initial impression of Lee? What did he take away from that friendship and knowledge? And let's talk about the assassination of JFK and what we do know from their perspective. We'll do that next on Coast to Coast AM. One of our two guests for the remainder of the show, Jim Botello, is a former Marine roommate of Lee Harvey Oswald. Jim, talk to me a little bit about when you first met Lee. What was he like when you first encountered him?
Well, is that a question you're asking me? No?
Yes.
Yeah, he was very polite and considerate, humble. He was a good man. He was, in fact, I considered him the best roommate I've ever had up until this present day. And he would become a little bit upset and arrogant when people questioned his honesty or integrity. But, and here, as I mentioned previously, he wouldn't compromise his principles for anyone, and he's a very intelligent young man too. He taught himself the Russian language. Well, we roomed together, and he would speak talk to us other roommates with a Russian language accent, make an effort at using the Russian accent, and questions, say, we'd respond da and yet, and call him Comrade Oswald Oswalskovich, in fact, was a nickname that we gave him.
And you guys didn't find that a little strange that he was so invested in that kind of persona?
Did I find it strange? No, I thought he had an interest in the Russian language, wanted to learn it. Many people have certain skills that they wanted to develop while in the Marine Corps. Some like shooting, some liked playing pool, and here again, he enjoyed playing chess. He was a fairly good chess player. He certainly was better than I was.
Well, a lot of the accounts have him as this subversive and socialist and into this. Was he a devout...
I'm sorry?
Was he a devout American? I mean, was he somebody that believed in his country, stood behind the country, or was he becoming disillusioned with it at the time you knew him?
He was a Marine. He believed in this country. From what I understand, he wore a ring with a Marine Corps emblem on his hand until he died. He was a Marine. He was a Marine clear through.
Talk to me about what your thoughts were, Jim, when you heard the president had been assassinated and Lee Harvey Oswald was being brought in as the assassin.
It was just, I felt in a state of shock. It was as if a family member had been, had that accusation. And wanted to know who saw him shoot Kennedy. Because having been accused within such a short period of time, I was a police officer at the time when I got the news of the assassination, and being accused at such a rapid period of time, I wondered who the witness was that happened to know that he shot him and he shot Kennedy. And within a period of 15 minutes, I believe, the accusation was made with the specific name and so forth. So it was unrealistic to me. It still is.
It didn't add up for you. There was no point when you said, you know, I could see this. I could see this being a possibility.
No, it wouldn't be a possibility for me either. I wasn't particularly fond of Kennedy, but no way I would ever consider doing anything like that. And I know he wouldn't have either.
Chris, with all that we know now, all of the things that have come forward, which would definitely support the fact that at least Oswald was not working alone if he truly was involved in this scenario, why do you think that there is still such a heavy burden put on his shoulders at this point?
Well, because they needed Apache. They needed to blame somebody else. They needed the misdirection. Because, again, if Lee Oswald didn't do it, then who did? And who had the power to pull off the cover-up? And there was a massive amount of effort put into this operation. Assassinations just don't happen. They are done by a script. And a lot of the script has to do with the cover-up, because the people that did it wanted to get away. Okay? Now, again, it's 52 years that it happened. There's been a lot of water under the bridge. People have talked. There are some amazing documents. And people have done amazing research from many different angles. And one of the things that I came across in the early 90s was a book by the name of Defrauding America by Rodney Stick. And in there, he had the testimony of a gentleman from Naval Intelligence by the name of Trent Parker. And what Trent Parker told Rodney was that Naval Intelligence was shadowing Hoover, and they captured a conversation between Hoover, Johnson, Dulles, George H.W. Bush, and Nelson Rockefeller. And for my money, that is the crew that did it, with a gentleman by the name of Ed Lansdale writing the script for it. Ed Lansdale was the head of Operation Mongoose. And Ed Lansdale, after my father started working with him in the 40s in World War II in psychological warfare, and it was because of a meeting that my father had with Ed Lansdale in 1956 in Vietnam that he left the CIA. And so there's aspects to this hit, because it was psychological warfare. It was directed really at the American people and our country, because it was a coup d'etat. They took over our country. And, you know, we all went into shock. Now, on Saturday night there, we had a historic panel where we had, because there's been questions about LBJs. Now, for my thinking, LBJ was a low man on the, Hoover was the lowest, and then came LBJ, because if you stood up quite a higher and had access to what was going on, both LBJ and Hoover were very much blackmailable. And then you had Dulles. Dulles is a lawyer. He's a facilitator. And who's he a lawyer for? The Bushes and the Rockefellers. Well, we had a panel about LBJ, and we brought together Ed Tatro, who was an advisor to Oliver Stone and also an advisor to Nigel Turner for the men who killed Kennedy. And then we had Barr McClellan, who was a lawyer in Johnson's law firm and got personal testimony there. And then we had Phil Nelson, who's written two books about LBJ's involvement. And he's basically the outsider who
has done a lot of research and went out and collected a lot of information. And then we had also Roger Stone, who Nixon told him some things about the JFK assassination and LBJ. And so we had all these different perspectives, and it was quite interesting. It went on for hours. And then yesterday, the anniversary of the assassination, some people are talking. Their lawyers are getting together, and they're trying to make it a case. And we had a lawyer get up there, and he says, you know, the chain of evidence, and I can't talk about them all because there were just so many. If there was a trial, Lee Harvey Oswald would be found innocent. And then we had St. John Hunt speak, and then we went down, and there was a ceremony at the mall. And we worked together with the Lancer Conference, and it was amazing. I talked to a lot of people who had been to these mall grassy knoll ceremonies, and we had one of the largest crowds ever. Peter Dale Scott told me, he said, you know, it just hit him in his heart because he'd been there for many, many years going to these things, and always it was a sad and kind of thing. Well, he saw hope. He saw that, you know, the people are understanding and the people, you know, want to know, because I don't know. I don't like to be lied to, do you?
No, nobody likes to be lied to, especially when we feel it's from our government, and what are they hiding from us? But knowing what you know, Chris, about the Kennedy administration, the mistakes Kennedy was making, the positioning that he was taking, can you see why he needed to go? Does that make sense to you at all from any of the angles?
No, I wouldn't agree with those people that say because of those things that he needed to go. And actually, I'm a bit of a minority, but when I look at the Kennedy assassination, I see ducks that were put in a row before Kennedy was even elected. And for my money, the biggest thing about the Kennedy assassination was the psychological warfare hit against the American people. We went into shock. Once you go into shock, you can be manipulated. It happened on, you know, these people were powerful. They didn't need to kill Kennedy in broad daylight, in public, on Bloody Elm Street, right across from the First Masonic Temple at Dealey Plaza, which is the form of a trident, has an obelisk. It's a ritual kill site. And when you kill the king on an occult significant day, such as 11/22, you read any books about classical numerology, and 11 and 22 are your highest numbers. There's no numbers in between. There's no numbers higher. And one of their main meanings is mastery and super mastery. So if you kill the king, okay, it's a ritual. You can read about it in James Frazer's book on the Golden Bough. You kill the king and take his power. And if you do that on a cult significant today, 11/22, where you're flashing to the people that you're the masters, well, gosh, if they're the masters, then, you know, I guess we're the slaves. And, you know, my father, when he first talked to me, he talked to me about drugs, the Vietnam War, and these secret societies. So I studied a lot about these secret societies. And they are very much invested in this type of psychological warfare ritual to get their way. When you look at these secret societies from a quote-unquote magical standpoint, and you look at what they do, the initiation rites and different things that they do, and their symbols, they are basically sorcerers who play a thing called death magic. By killing people, they get power. That's what they believe. And It's criminal. And the dynamic is, I strongly believe, and I'm very optimistic, in the people's favor, because we have the personal computer and the internet now. And one thing the personal computer has done is taken things that, you know, used to be infinite. Oh, well, we can't figure those out. Well, with the personal computer and the internet, we can really figure things out. And I really think that we can, if we people stand up, we can take our country back. So, because, you know, we still have a constitutional republic. They may have eaten around the edges, okay, but that paper is still there. And that's what allows me to publish these suppressed books, because I'm a musician. I'm amazed that I'm a publisher, and I'm a publisher because they have suppressed so much information that it just, you know, it's like a tree trying to get through the sidewalk. If it doesn't come right through it, it comes out through the side. And there are way more of us than there are of them, and we can take our country back. So I'm very hopeful. And this conference was just, it was just amazing, because when you get all these people together, yeah, we may have read each other's books and stuff, but when you get together and you have discussion and you have the audience and they ask questions, you really learn a lot and you really see what's going on. So,
well, you talked about the fact that that there was this meeting and that this group was being shadowed. First of all, if it was that powerful a group of men, how could they not know that they were being watched or shadowed or covered?
What group are you talking about?
When you were talking about George Bush and you had the Rockefellers and Dulles and all of these people that were involved.
If you read, there is quite a bit of information that the Office of Naval Intelligence was given in ages to basically go off reservation and start looking back at the government after World War One, because, you know, my daddy told me some things I didn't understand, okay, many years ago, and I did a lot of research, and, you know, so I'm kind of, you know, excuse me, I think I figured some things out. Well, there's people in Washington and other places who, you know, have a lot of resources, and they figured it out. And if these people were shadowed, if they knew it at the time, I don't think they did. Okay? And there comes a point when, at some point in time, all you can do is take notes. And that's basically what's going on, because the power that these people have is quite strong. And if you look at, you know, they've all the unexpected and unexplained deaths of witnesses. I mean, Judith Vary Baker, the people that she was working with in Louisiana.
Right, but as I said, though, I mean, you've got this.
All of them are dead.
Right, you've got this powerful group. How could they not know that somebody's watching out for them if they are this power group and part of secret society? It would seem like they would have been able to shelter themselves from being caught or overheard at all.
Well, again,
or do you think that you just get into such a?
They're awful arrogant, that's just some testimony that we have. And I believe that, yes, there are. You know, they were able to shadow them. So that's what I believe.
They were developed. They had another goal, a very strong goal, to kill. The cancer cells, to cure cancer. This was the goal that they had, and to develop cancer, to see how they could cure cancer. And this was, they were dedicated to this particular goal. Whereas the people in back of them had another goal, a separate, and so
accomplish.
Well, let's talk about that goal. We have to take a break. When we come back, we'll talk about these goals. Why would they want the president dead, and what would that have to do with curing cancer? What would the secondary reason for killing the president be from this power magnet group? We'll talk about that. We'll take your calls and do all that in the next hour right here on Coast to Coast AM.